Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Sports are a big business in the U.S., with popular events like yesterday's Super Bowl, NASCAR, and the Major League Baseball playoffs. Sports has grown into a multi-billion dollar business. Over the past 20 years, there's been a boom in the construction of mega arenas, with much of the cost subsidized. Between 1991 and 2006, 64 Major League facilities were built. And then there's the college level. Last month, the USA Today survey found that more than $800 million in student fees and university subsidies are supporting athletic programs at the nation's top sports colleges. On today's Agenda for a New Economy series, we're talking about why we treat sports teams different from other businesses. Why has society really accepted so many of these sweet deals that the government gives to sports teams? Dave Zirin is a sports correspondent for The Nation magazine, and he recently wrote a piece called It's Time for a Sports Fan Coalition. He says $30 billion in public subsidies have gone into stadium funding over the last quarter century, and it's become a substitute for anything resembling an urban policy in the United States. That's why Dave Zirin is involved in a new organization called the Sports Fan Coalition, a nonprofit made up of sports fans who want to demand a seat at the table. Dave's latest book is titled A People's History of Sports in the U.S., 250 Years of Politics, Protest, People, and Play. And Dave joins us from New York. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Now, many people, especially many sports fans, say that the construction of these new multi-million dollar arenas actually help local economies. So do they? A study commissioned by the South Florida Super Bowl host committee said the 2007 game generated $463 million in the surrounding counties in South Florida. And they say they expect about the same when you look at yesterday's Super Bowl. But Andrew Zimbalist, a prominent sports economist at Smith College, says if you can move the decimal point one digit to the left, you'd actually get a more realistic estimate, saying if they were arguing $40 million, I would say that's a realistic impact. $400 million is not. Professor Zimbalist has authored many books on the economy of sports. His most recent is Baseball and Billions, a probing look inside the big business of our national pastime. And he's coming out with a new book called Circling the Bases. And Andrew joins us from Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rose.
It's nice to have you. So, Dave Zirin, I want to start with you. Before we dive in and talk about subsidies and sports teams, you wrote a piece last night right after the New Orleans Saints won the Super Bowl for The Nation magazine. What are you hearing from the people in New Orleans today?
Well, not a lot, because they're still partying right now. It is a wild scene in New Orleans right now. And let me say, I'm one of those people who is a born skeptic when it comes to the typical sports writing trope about great team wins championship, lifts city out of doldrums. And there have been about half a dozen of these stories that have come out of the Detroit, Michigan area over the last couple of years. But this is really something different in terms of what's happening in New Orleans right now. New Orleans is a city whose residents feel incredibly disrespected and forgotten, with very just cause, since Hurricane Katrina and even before Hurricane Katrina. And now that the Saints have won the Super Bowl, everybody from George Bush to Brownie has to acknowledge New Orleans and the Saints. Barack Obama, who never mentions New Orleans enough for the people of New Orleans, and I think, frankly, for any of us who care about the rebuilding of New Orleans, now has to greet the New Orleans Saints at the White House. And this is causing an incredible feeling of satisfaction for the people of New Orleans. And when you couple that with the fact that a lot of the players actually live in New Orleans and are very humble about the role that winning a Super Bowl actually means to the city, they have a very, very stirring and sharp sense of perspective about that. I think they're, you can do nothing except cheer the fact that they won last night.
And will they get an invitation to the White House?
Oh, most definitely. And Barack Obama is going to actually have to say the two words, which he's barely uttered in his presidency, New Orleans.
So I have to admit, Dave, I wasn't really following the Super Bowl this year until I read your piece. And I really liked your article. And it got me thinking about today's show and about sports subsidies. I'm sure we have a lot of sports fans listening. We don't do that many shows, frankly, about sports on Your Call. But why would you say someone who maybe doesn't follow sports should be interested in a show about subsidies and what you term the athletic industrial complex?
Well, Ralph Nader used to have this expression where he said, you got to turn on the politics or politics will turn on you. I think there's a version of that with sports in that you have to pay attention to at least what's happening in the sports world, or else you can find out that the sports world has turned its attention on you, because so many cultural messages, racism, sexism, homophobia, are absolutely channeled through sports, particularly on the area of militarism, which is why yesterday, Super Bowl, we did a party with Iraq Veterans Against the War that we called an anti-militarism Super Bowl party, which I actually recommend. And but also this issue of stadium subsidies and the fact that the public funding of sports teams has substituted for anything resembling an urban policy in this country. As I said, I think it's just the excrement of urban neoliberalism. And I learned a lot by reading the work of Andrew Zimbalist. So, I mean, you look at my pieces on it, oftentimes they're just like huge block quotes from Professor Zimbalist. So you have the right person to talk to about it online here. And that's the problem with it. It's like, if we want to understand urban development, if we want to understand the state of fighting racism, sexism, homophobia in our society, understanding sports becomes a very important part of that.
And Professor Zimbalist, let's bring you in here. What would you add to that? I mean, you have written many books about this. How do you get people to really pay attention to what's happening with the sports industry?
I think, first of all, that the job...
Oh, you know what? I think we're having problems with Professor Zimbalist's line.
You can't hear me well?
I can't hear you very well.
Okay.
We will...
I hear you loud and clear.
You know, I think it's on my end, actually. Go ahead, Professor.
Okay, let me know if you need me to stop. So I think that as a professor and as a researcher, my job isn't so much to mobilize people as it is to educate people and inform them. And the main thing that I've been concerned with regard to stadium and arena projects is that they're usually promoted by pro-stadium coalitions that are very well funded. And one of the things that these coalitions do is they go out and they hire a consulting company to do a report that says that a new sports stadium or arena will be the cat's meow for the local economy. And all of the scholarly research on this question comes to a very different conclusion. And so mostly what I've tried to do is to look at the empirical evidence, see if it can be understood in different ways, do different kinds of statistical testing, and then to explain why the results that come out of the econometric work, to explain the results, try to make it understandable about why a sports team by itself or a sports facility by itself can't be depended on to promote local economic development.
And in one of Dave's latest pieces, he writes about the $30 billion in public subsidies that have gone into stadium funding over the last quarter century.
Right.
Is it safe to say that it's different depending on or different in every city?
Yeah, it is safe to say that. Well, first of all, teams that are located in the largest cities in the United States don't have very much leverage. Back in the 1990s, when Giuliani was mayor in New York City, the Yankees were threatening to leave New York unless they got public money to build a new Yankee stadium. That was kind of a silly threat. I can't believe that any serious politician in New York thought it was credible, because why would any baseball team want to leave New York? They could leave New York and go where, to Topeka, Kansas, and get Topeka to build them a new stadium. It's not going to be better for the owner, for the Steinbrenners, to do something like that. So generally in large cities, teams don't have as much leverage, and what you find in large cities is that the subsidies will be smaller. And then in medium and smaller size cities, depending on the details of the circumstance, the public subsidies tend to be much larger. The other thing is that, you know, the studies that I referred to earlier that make conclusions or draw conclusions about lack of economic impact, those are large-scale studies that are conducted over dozens and dozens of cases over decades. And to come out with a general conclusion that you can't expect or anticipate that a new facility will improve economic conditions doesn't mean that in any particular case it couldn't have a marginal impact that would be a little positive or a little negative. There again, it depends upon the details. How is the financing done? What does the lease look like? Does the city get to keep any revenue that's generated at the facility? Where is the facility going to be placed? How much does the land cost, and how much does infrastructure cost? So there are all sorts of very complicated and detailed questions that will make the situation and the impact of the arena or the stadium somewhat different from case to case.
And what really stands out for you? Can you give us a specific example? In December, the New York Times had a piece called Stadium Boom Deepens Municipal Woes, and they wrote about what's happening in Cincinnati, where two sports arenas were supposed to cost a total of $500 million, but they cost almost $1 billion.
Right.
And they're saying that because the taxpayers had to foot so much of the bill, and it's not bringing in that much revenue, they have to cut social services as a result.
Right. Well, look, I mean, first of all, one of the things that taxpayers have to be very cautious about is that when politicians join together with the owner of the sports team and with investment bankers and with architectural and construction firms, and they form this very awesome and formidable coalition of wealthy and powerful people, one of the things that they invariably do is lowball their first estimate, because well, you know, what they want to do is get the city council, or the county commissioners or the state legislature or all three of those groups. They want them to vote yes on a stadium proposal. The best way to get them to vote yes is to have a lowball proposal first. And so they keep all the bells and whistles out, and they don't consider the various problems, environmental remediation issues and so on, that will present themselves, and they come out with a low estimate. And because they come out with a low estimate, that's the one that's usually approved politically, then once it's approved, they start adding the bells and whistles, and they start discovering problems, and they have delays. All these things cost a lot more money. So it's very typical to have an overrun, a cost overrun. It could be 20%, it could be 40%, could be 100%. But so one of the things that's very important to do is to push that issue and to build in guarantees that if there is going to be political approval for public funding, that there be certain limitations on it.
And Dave Zirin, you're involved in a new group called the Sports Fan Coalition. How do these subsidies and just the sheer amount of money spent on arenas and sports teams, how does this actually affect the fans?
Well, it affects the fans in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, one of the things it does is it exposes the lie that people have been told in cities over the last generation, which is that, well, you just can't throw money at the problem when it comes to schools. You just can't throw money at the problem when it comes to hospitals. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. They shut down the only public hospital. The schools have been subject to vicious cuts. And they always say, well, it's because you just can't throw money at these things. Mm. And yet when it comes to sports stadiums, one of the things it exposes is that, well, actually there is fat on the system. There is something in the kitty here. And yet it's being used to build welfare hotels for the very rich. And I think that's really what gets under people's skin about this stuff. And it reminds me, the professor mentioned Rudolph Giuliani. It reminds me of this famous quote from Giuliani when he was asked by the press about why he would not allow a referendum about the new stadium construction in New York. And he said, well, you can't have a referendum because if you have one, the people won't vote for it. And I think that sums up the arrogance that often takes place when you have that unholy union between political leaders, pro-sports team owners, and then the fruit of that union is, of course, these publicly funded stadiums.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Your Call, and it's our Monday series, Agenda for a New Economy. And today we're talking about why we treat sports teams different from other businesses. And we'll dive into that question more after the break. But what are your thoughts on all of these subsidies that go to sports teams? What kind of regulations do you think should be imposed? Do you think that having a sports team in your area helps local economies? We have a number of sports arenas here in the Bay Area. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And you can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. It's 20 minutes after 11 o'clock. At noon today, alternative radio, Bridging the Media Gap with Amy Goodman. And then at 2 o'clock, The State We're In, stories from all over the world with a special focus on human rights issues, produced by Radio Netherlands. And I should mention, too, at noon, it's Grit Radio with Laura Flanders, right here on KALW. Stay tuned.
Bye.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a discussion about plans to bring the Taliban back on the political scene in Afghanistan. Afghan President Hamid Karzai wants to talk to Taliban leaders, and his backers here in the U.S. and Europe seem to be all for it. So how did this major shift happen so quickly? And then on Wednesday, Sandeep Roy will have a conversation with Joel Kotkin. He's author of The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. How will a population surpassing 400 million people transform the U.S. in the next 40 years? That's on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea for us or a comment, you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, it's our Monday series, Agenda for a New Economy, and we're talking about why we treat sports teams different from other businesses. $30 billion in public subsidies have gone into stadium funding over the last quarter century. And today's guests, actually Dave Zirin, is involved with a new organization called the Sports Fan Coalition, saying that sports fans need to demand a seat at the table. So we'd love to hear from you if you're a sports fan, or even if you're not a sports fan, if you have any questions about subsidies and how they work, we'd love to hear from you. And then why do you think this issue doesn't really get that much attention? If a team, for example, says that it's going to move cities, it gets a lot of attention, front page coverage, fans are outraged by this, they really speak their opinion, but then when it comes to subsidies, we don't really hear that much of a conversation. Why is that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Do you think there should be any regulations imposed on sports franchises? And then how do you think this really does affect the fans when it comes to the cost of a game? It's been increasing. Ticket prices are increasing. T-shirts almost across the board have been increasing. Are you finding yourself maybe not participating as much as you used to? 866-798-8255. And you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Dave Zirin, sports correspondent with The Nation magazine. And he's involved in the new organization called Sports Fan Coalition. His latest book is A People's History of Sports in the U.S. And we're joined by Andrew Zimbalist, a prominent sports economist at Smith College. His book, latest book, is Baseball and Billions. And his forthcoming book is called Circling the Bases. And let's hear from a caller who's got a very on-point question. Let's go to Max in San Francisco. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question. I'm curious about how this all began. What are the origins of public government involvement in sports teams and sports facilities? Because I really don't know, you know, just sort of taken for granted. I wonder where that started.
Yeah, it's a great question. Andrew, do you want to take
sure.
that one?
Yeah. Well, not the modern era of it, but there are instances of it that go back to Roosevelt's Work Progress Administration during the Great Depression, where, you know, they were doing all sorts of public works. But I think the modern era really starts in the 1950s when in baseball, you had from the beginning of baseball in 1903 all the way until the beginning of the 50s, the same 16 teams playing in the same cities. And then all of a sudden, the Boston Braves go to Milwaukee, and the Philadelphia A's go to Kansas City. And then a few years later, the Dodgers and the Giants move out to California. And so what started to happen was that baseball realized that there are all these cities that were very small in 1903 that weren't worthy of a baseball, Major League Baseball team, perhaps in 1903. But by the 1950s, they're large and thriving metropolises, and they could be used to bid against each other to get baseball teams. And so I think each of the major leagues at that point started to realize that they had some economic leverage. They're basically each a monopoly, whether it's MLB in baseball or NFL in football, NBA in basketball, et cetera. They had some leverage. And as each of the leagues got more popular, as football started to get very popular at the end of the 50s and into the 60s, and as basketball got very popular in the early 80s, they had more and more leverage. One of the reasons, by the way, to answer in part your good questions that you were posing, Rose, one of the reasons why there's not more overt protest about this is because sports is very, very popular. People want to have sports teams. And if you think about building a $500 million stadium in a city that, let's say, has 5 million inheadtenants, or in a larger metropolitan area that has 5 million inhabitants, the debt service on a $500 million stadium, yearly debt service, will be under $50 million. And if there are 5 million people living in the area, that's $10 per capita. So it's when people think about what kind of a contribution they have to make yearly on a yearly basis to have a sports team or to have what they think will be a more successful sports team being only $10, where sports is so, so very popular in our society, it becomes a little bit more understandable why there aren't large protests about it. The other thing I think that's important to point out here is that many of the recent stadiums that have been built and arenas that have been built have been part of a larger agreement where the owner of the team might get a lot of public funding, but the owner then commits funding for adjacent development, whether commercial, residential, retail development. And sometimes the entire project, even if the stadium or the arena by itself won't promote economic development, the entire project can be a positive force for development. So I think, you know, a lot of things are going on here that help to explain a little bit why it's not more of an issue.
Well, what about that question that when you do put so much money into a new arena, new parking lot, new food, for example, I mean, I don't even know what it's called anymore, AT&T Park here in San Francisco.
Right.
It tends to change corporate names every
right.
5 years or so.
Right.
But a lot of people say, hey, that brings in jobs. In fact, a friend here at the station who just left with a Cincinnati Reds hat on, he said, wait a minute. You know, he's a huge sports fan, and he said when these new stadiums are built yeah. and the teams are kept in San Francisco, for example, it brings in lots of new jobs and new revenue. Is that true?
Generally not. Generally, a team by itself or a facility by itself does not promote development. And the primary reason for that is most of the money that gets spent at AT&T Park or that gets spent at any professional sports stadium is recirculated money in the local economy. That is, people have relatively fixed leisure budgets, and if they take their family to a baseball game and spend $200 or $300 or $400 some evening, it's $200 or $300 or $400 that they're not going to spend at the local opera house or at local restaurants or at local bowling alleys. And basically, it's just money spent in one part of the city instead of money spent at the other part of the city. It's not new to the economy. Now, to the extent that the San Francisco Giants or the San Francisco 49ers or the Oakland A's or any other team in the Bay Area brings people from other parts of the country into their town in order to watch the game, and that new money gets spent as a result of that, then there might be some positive impact. But there are a lot of other forces that are at play here that could weaken that impact.
Yeah.
Dave, yeah. Do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, everything the professor said is right on point. The one thing that I would also add is anytime you talk about money that goes into a stadium, you always have to ask yourself, well, if that money had gone somewhere else, would that have had a better economic impact? And the other thing I would say is that this isn't a question of opinion, like I think stadiums are a bad investment, you think they're a good investment. I mean, we're talking about objective criteria here. I mean, every study that I've read from the Brookings Institute to the Cato Institute comes to the same conclusion, that at the end of the day, they are a net loser. And one of those reasons is the issue of oversaturation in sports. I mean, it used to be there was a team in a region, so people would travel from that region to go see the club. Now it is much more localized in terms of fandom, so you don't have that outside money coming in. And the other thing is take something like a football stadium, for example, and think about all the surrounding business of a football stadium. Say your team doesn't make the playoffs. That's 8 days out of a 365-day year where something major is going on there that day. I mean, that's just not a smart civic investment.
All right. Thank you.
If I could just qualify that quickly,
sure.
Maybe the first point of disagreement that Dave and I have had here is the studies don't show that stadiums and teams are net losers. They show that they're economically neutral. Dave is right. If you're looking for an economic boost, you should look at what the alternative uses of that money is. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that it's not just an economic boost, presumably, that having a good sports team in your community can give you. There are non-economic features that can be positive, and it's important to understand that if you want to also mobilize people or get people involved in the issue, have a full understanding of what has kept them from being more involved until now.
All right, well, thank you again for calling in, Max. And let's go next to Mariva in San Francisco. Hi, Mariva.
Yes, hi. I'd like to ask about the possibility of getting more teams that are actually municipally owned, that is owned by the local cities and communities that they're actually a part of, rather than being corporate owned. And I look to the Green Bay Packers as a model for this, where everything that the stadium and the team makes, all the funds that they and revenue that they generate is actually recycled back into the communities. It goes back into local schools, into charities, local services. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard that the NFL actually got together after that happened and made a rule that only corporations could own teams after that, and teams could no longer be municipally owned. And so I have a big problem with that, because if we need to pony up the cash for stadiums, then I think it's only fair that the people also own the teams. I think it's fantastic that the Saints won last night in the Super Bowl. It's very inspiring, but frankly, those people who live in New Orleans should all be owning a piece of the Saints. It shouldn't just be one person or one family or one private corporation. So I'd like to find out what you think about that.
No, I think it's very reasonable. It's a good thought. None of the leagues permit municipal ownership. The Green Bay Packers were formed in 1922 or 23, at a point in time when the league did not have rules about that. And they've been grandfathered, so they can continue to do that. Down the coast from you in San Francisco, back in 1989, Joan Kroc owned the San Diego Padres, and she wanted to give the Padres to the city to be owned municipally. Major League Baseball had a rule that said that that couldn't happen, and the team ended up getting sold to the partnership led by Tom Werner. So this is across the board, but you know, given the public investments that are made in the teams, emotional investment and financial investments, given the way people in the United States totally involve themselves in local teams, given the free publicity they get in the newspapers and on the television and on the radio constantly, all day long, all season long, all year long, yes, it would make a lot of sense for there to be municipal ownership. There would be some complications to it, to be sure, but it's not, absent some very major political pressure from Congress, it's not something that the leagues are about to give in on. They don't want to have municipal ownership. It means that their operations are open to the public, that their books are open. And they think it's too messy.
And is the Green Bay Packers the only team that's owned by the city?
Yes.
On a
it's
major
really
league
owned
level,
by the city.
There are a couple minor league teams.
Yeah, that's
that
right. That's absolutely
owned.
Right. Minor league level, the leagues do allow it. Baseball is really the only league that has a developed minor league that's affiliated. Hockey has a smaller one. But the Green Bay Packers are not owned by the city. The Green Bay Packers are owned by a group of people who used to live in Green Bay, some of whom who still live in Green Bay, but you're not allowed to sell your stock in the Packers. The people have moved away from Green Bay, so they're probably people in the Bay Area who now own a piece of that team. But they don't get any profits from the team. They don't pass out dividends, and they don't have any effective control. So it's really kind of a trophy bit of ownership.
Don't even get primo seats at Lambeau Field.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty cool, actually. I mean, if you've ever been to Green Bay, you would never think for a second that this is a city that has an NFL team. And you think about some of the Rust Belt cities in this country and what, if say, the team itself was municipally owned, what that could mean for a given community. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that the question and this whole discussion is exactly what my next book's about. It's called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Mm. And the argument comes out this summer. And the whole argument of the book is that we own these teams more than owners own these teams. They're part of our collective history. They're the stories we hand down to our kids. And the idea that they could just pick them up and move them to another city, the idea that they could extort local municipalities to get money from us, is actually an argument that states they are not actually fit to own these teams, and we are.
Dave, do you think, though, because with your Sports Fan Coalition, you're saying that sports fans want a seat at the table. Do you think that people would get involved in something like this? I mean, when you look at the Yankees and the Mets costing a combined $2.3 billion for those mm-hmm. stadiums, was there a huge outcry just among the fans? And I'm not talking about
those stadiums
people
are privately funded, Rose.
They're privately
funded. They both did get a lot of public money. I mean, Dennis Kucinich did hearings about it on the Hill, because of their thought that there were like real cost run-ups and abuses. Especially given some of the infrastructure issues in New York, I mean, I bring it back to what Rudolph Giuliani said about we're not going to have a referendum because if we have a referendum, the people won't vote on it. I mean, there certainly was a lot of not just dissatisfaction in New York, but also a lot of real broken promises, like with the new Yankee Stadium would come city parks and rec centers for the youth of the South Bronx. None of that came to pass. And actually, the person who facilitated the whole deal, this guy Adolfo Carrion, is now has a huge position in the Obama administration on urban policy. And to me, that really says something. You facilitate the new Yankee Stadium, you get a plum federal job on the question of urban policy. So it's like they still haven't broken themselves of this habit that sees municipal funding for stadiums as a substitute for how we're going to develop our cities. And I think we're all the worse off for that.
Here's a different version of what happened in New York. The Yankees spent $1.5 billion of their own money to build a stadium. There's something like $350 million of infrastructure money coming from the city and the state. The ballparks that the parkland that Dave refers to is some of it's been built. Other parts of it have not been built, but they will be built. The new ballpark, City Park in Queens, $800 million of the Mets money and a couple hundred million dollars of public money. Nobody should make an argument that there isn't public funding there, but the public funding has been for infrastructure, and if you put the infrastructure and the stadium costs together, it comes to under 20%. Of public money. The typical stadium deal is 70% public and 30% private. So I think it's important to represent what's going on, as accurately as you can.
Yeah, thank you for that. And also, are you finding that are more and more arenas now becoming publicly funded, or is it just a mixture?
It's the same mixture that it's always been. What you find is that there are particular cases, again, which tend to be in larger cities that have more private funding, and some cases that are in smaller cities that have all public funding. But when you put them all together decade by decade, it's been fairly constant at around 70% public funding and 30% private over the last 4 or 5 decades.
And that is Andrew Zimbalist, a prominent sports economist at Smith College. His latest book is Baseball and Billions, and his forthcoming book is Circling the Bases. We're also joined today by Dave Zirin, sports correspondent with The Nation magazine. He's involved in a new group called the Sports Fan Coalition. It's a nonprofit made up of sports fans who want to demand a seat at the table to talk about whether or not these arenas should be funded by taxpayer money. Dave's latest book is A People's History of Sports in the U.S., and his forthcoming book is called Bad Sports. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about sports subsidies. In the last quarter century, $30 billion in public subsidies have gone into stadium funding. What are your thoughts on these subsidies? If you have any questions about how arenas are funded and then how all of this money is really dispersed, who really is the winner here when you look at the cost of the concessions and the parking and everything else that costs so much these days to go to a baseball or a football game? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. If you're a sports fan, do you think that maybe you would get involved in something like the Sports Fan Coalition? What do you think would really get so many people that get riled up when a team says they're going to move and it gets front page paper? What do you think it would take to get them also involved in the politics behind this and the subsidies? 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, sure, Dave.
Well, I'm just looking at us up in the Daily News as we're talking, because I just in the Daily News it said that $941 million of tax-exempt public bonds were issued for the $1.3 billion Yankee Stadium, and then they said they wouldn't finish it without $400 million more in public funds. That just sounds much more egregious than the professor was saying, or is the Daily News not?
No, they got tax-exempt financing, but that's not public money. That's bonds that are issued through the Stadium Corporation or through the Parks Commission that enables the Yankees and the Mets and every other team in the United States to have tax-free financing. So it enables them to have lower interest rates than they would get if the interest on the bonds was taxed.
Do you think that qualifies as corporate welfare when you have them as tax-exempt bonds?
Well,
it's not a question. I'm really curious.
I think it's a complicated question, and I think that it addresses not the subsidy from New York and the subsidy from individual cities to the teams, but federal policy. Should we have a federal policy that in essence underwrites and encourages cities to bid against each other by giving them cheaper the opportunities for cheaper financing to build stadiums. And I'm not in favor of that, but that's different than a subsidy from New York. The Yankees got to have tax-free financing, and it helped them lower the overall cost of the stadium. But it's still the total cost that the Yankees are financing is going to be $1.5 billion.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I want to thank Mariva. Thank you for your call. I didn't know that about the Green Bay Packers, so thanks for bringing that into the conversation. And we have full line, so let's hear from some more callers. Let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, hi. So one of the issues is naming rights on these stadiums. So here in San Francisco, we have a ballpark that's called AT&T Park or something like that. And I think there's a very simple way that the activist community could get involved here. That field should be called Willie Mays Park. So we could make up two sample bumper stickers and meet with AT&T, a bunch of activist groups, and say, we're going to print 100,000 of these bumper stickers, and you can choose which one. One says Willie Mays Field, and then in smaller letters, at AT&T Park, and the other just says Willie Mays Field or Willie Mays Park. And you say to them, which one do you want us to print 100,000 of them? Because we're going to hand them out free. Bumper stickers are really cheap to print. Because that field should be named Willie Mays Field because he was the greatest player ever to play for the Giants. It shouldn't be named after some big corporation. I think we need to start thinking in terms of things we, the people, can do to change this. It's great to criticize it and wring our hands, but we need to get activist energy in here.
Okay, so let me, if I could, Rose. Look, Peter McGowan, who owned the Giants back in 2000 when the field was completed, financed that privately. There was no public money there at all. I think there was something like $10 million to build a boat dock or something like that. But it was all privately financed. And the way he was able to afford that was that he made a deal, naming rights deal back then with Pac Bell. And I don't remember how much Pac Bell gave him, but it was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 to $5 million a year, maybe more than that. And it enabled private financing. Without the naming rights deal with the private corporation, there would have been public money or the stadium wouldn't have been built at all. So I think it's nice to call it Willie Mays Park. He's a great ball player. It'd be wonderful to do that, but I think you then present yourself with a financing issue, and that would be true for most stadiums and arenas in the United States today. Those naming rights deal help the public portion of the funding go down.
How much do stadiums get from these corporations on average for
naming
rights?
Well, really, it varies tremendously from city to city and from league to league, but somewhere between $1 and $20 million a year, and some of the deals are 20 and 30 years long.
Kevin, are you still with us?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? What the professor said? If you don't give AT&T the right to name the stadium, it might go right back to the taxpayers.
Well, I know the professor's worked quite well, and he's a really good scholar and a smart guy. And it is a problem, and we have to look at what is the cost. How do you measure the cost of everything being branded by corporations so everybody is thinking that we work for them instead of them working for us? They exist because every state has an element of its state constitution allowing corporations to exist. We, the people, are supposed to run this country, and unfortunately the corporations have taken over our government, the public airwaves, the food system, the healthcare system, and everything else. We got to take it back.
And if I could just jump in, too, it's like a lot of times with the naming rights, it's not just, I mean, it would be great. I'd be all for corporate branding on naming rights if all owners paid for their own stadiums and were looking to fray the cost, but in some cases it's just like the sweet cherry on the sundae of the deal, like extra easy money. And I think we lose something as fans there because, I mean, I have real memories of being a kid and growing up and going to places like a Veterans Stadium, you know, these RFK Stadium, these imposing names, Shea Stadium, Yankee Stadium, and now it's like you know, nearby here, where do they play in Houston? They play at Minute Maid Park now, for goodness sakes. And they're called Minute Maid Park because Enron Field went under.
Right.
Did Enron Field, Minute Maid Park, I think you actually do lose something. And you do lose that balance over, well, who are these games really for at the end of the day?
Hmm.
I mean, maybe that's more ethereal and psychological than the numbers, but it's definitely something that sticks in my craw.
Well, are you also finding that because of just the sheer amount of money involved here, clear that everything is becoming much more corporate and upscale? Because I know that when we got the new stadium in San Francisco, I went with my dad, who's this very old school football baseball guy, and they had sushi there and all of these sort of upscale things, and he just thought it was so strange. And is that happening just across the country with new arenas?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. There was a seismic shift in 1992 when Camden Yards was built in downtown Baltimore. And the whole strategy that Larry Lucchino and Janet Marie Smith were pursuing back then, they took the old field, Memorial Field, that was up by Johns Hopkins, 10 miles to the north of the center of the city, and they moved it right to the center of the city next to the business district. The strategy was to bring the corporate dollar into the ballpark, get wealthier clientele sitting in the seats, making the signage worth more, and the price of the seats going up. And the Orioles experienced immediately a $30 million boost in their revenues. Other teams started following that and even upping that strategy. And so you get new stadiums now that generate as much as $100 million additional a year for a team, and it's all based on getting the corporate dollar and the wealthier clientele into the facility.
And who are the big winners here? I mean, we often hear about player salaries, but who else is paid big money because of this?
Well, if they do it right, the team owner can make out very well here, not only in terms of the bottom line every year, the income statements, but the value of the franchise can go way up. The players are major beneficiaries. If we didn't have public subsidies for stadiums and these stadiums didn't get built, then the teams would generate less revenue and the players would be worth a heck of a lot less. So these tend to be subsidies that go to the pockets of the players, sometimes into the pockets of the owners, and sometimes into the pockets of the executives who are associated with the team.
I would also put some of the local politicians on this, too, who can often benefit mightily from the largesse of team owners when they're trying to push a stadium deal through a state legislature.
All right. Thanks again for calling in, Kevin. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. It actually might be faster if you can send us an email because we have full lines at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston has studied this, as has Neil DeMaus, who wrote Field of Schemes. And one of the threads running through a bunch of cases they cite is that these millionaire owners get the cities to build them stadiums, and that raises the value of their teams, enriching them. They cite many examples of basically the public being held up and their tax dollars going to line these guys' pockets. New York City holds the leases on Shea and Yankee Stadium. Yet in the waning days of Giuliani's mayoralty, he allowed them to withhold $5 million a year of rent on their stadiums that they were paying the citizens of New York City. And they turned around and used this to hire lobbyists to lobby for more subsidies for new ballparks. And the citizens paid for this. And that's just a small example. It goes into the Washington Nationals, how they held up D.C. for $611 million in stadium money, and that raised the value of their team, which they then turn around and flip. I mean, there are the egregiousness of these people on the backs of the public in a so-called free enterprise market. It's ludicrous. We're being hosed.
Well, Ken, thank you for calling in. And David K. Johnston has been on several times talking about his book, Free Lunch. And then another connection he makes, Dave, I'm wondering if you've explored this at all. He says, in addition to what Ken brought up, there also tends to be an increase in violence in the inner city because money that could have gone to, say, an after-school program, for example, goes to this arena, and then these kids can't afford the tickets to see the game.
Well, I'm not going to speak directly to the question of violence, but I can speak directly to just the question of things like physical education programs, after-school programs, rec centers. It's hard not to see something causal, for example, between the shuttering of rec centers and the growth of these kinds of stadiums, or just even basically the fact that the number of African Americans who play Major League Baseball has gone from roughly 25% to under 8% over the last 20 years. And there's a reason for that. To play baseball, you need some sense of infrastructure. I mean, there are other reasons as well. But the main thing it does have to do with, like, the absence of infrastructure for major league talent and the hundreds of millions that have been invested in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela to develop players on the cheap who you don't have to sign for a lot of money. And it's changed the demographics of the sports. And so there's something profoundly anti-sport about this. This is happening in Vancouver right now, where billions went towards the Olympics. And with that came cuts of physical education programs. So it's something to keep in mind, because a lot of times when you're against stadiums, people say you're anti-sport. But I think anything that deprives young people from being able to actually play sports is anti-sport, not to mention what you mentioned, which is if you can't afford to go to the games anyway, then who are we getting these stadiums for?
And that 8% that you cite, is that across the board?
Yeah, under 8% of Major League Baseball players are of African descent. Huh.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ken. And before I get to calls, I just wanted to ask another question just about laws. I read that Major League Baseball and the NFL have exemptions from antitrust law. Andrew, is that true? And what's the history of these exemptions?
How much time do we have? Baseball was granted an antitrust exemption by the Supreme Court in 1922, and that exemption is presumed still to exist for the entirety of the sport, save labor relations. There was something passed in the U.S. Congress called the Curt Flood Act in 1998 that exempted labor relations from that exemption. Football has, along with baseball, basketball, and hockey, an exemption to sign national television contracts by the league so that the 32 independently owned football teams can come together as a cartel and sign one football contract. They're only supposed to do that for sponsored television, meaning over-the-air free television as opposed to cable, but generally it's been interpreted to also apply to cable. Beyond that, there was the U.S. Congress enabled the AFL and the NFL to join together as one league, to merge, and that was basically granting them an exemption from the antitrust laws. That was back in 1965. They made a deal with congressmen in Louisiana to do that, so that the Louisiana could get a football team, and they got the New Orleans Saints as a result of that deal. And then they also made a deal. Congress made a deal with the NBA to allow them to merge with four ABA teams in the 1970s. So those are the exemptions. Baseball is the only one that has a blanket exemption, though.
Do you think that should be changed?
I don't think that it actually has a large impact anymore today. For a whole slew of very complicated reasons. I don't think it matters a great deal one way or the other. The leagues certainly would like to have an exemption because it would lower the litigation costs that they experience from time to time. But I don't think beyond that it matters very much.
All right, and we have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Kathy in Santa Cruz. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I'm not really a sports fan, but I am a fan of politics. And I wonder if either of your gentlemen can explain the whole convoluted thing that went on with George W. Bush and the baseball team in Texas and the stadium. And my impression at the time and subsequently, that the only personal fortune he had was taxpayer money that was paid for the building of that stadium when he sold his share in the baseball team. And yeah. I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay, thanks, Kathy.
He made a deal with his other partners that he was going to invest something like $500,000 that he borrowed practically all of. And as a result, that $500,000, because his dad had some power in the world at the time, they got the state legislature to publicly fund a new stadium in Arlington. And when the Bush partnership, when George W. Bush's partnership sold the team, Bush walked away with $16 million. So that's basically the story. He lent the ownership group his father. His father got them the stadium, and George W. built a little bit of a fortune for himself.
Yeah, and also, you can't underestimate the degree to which that was also a platform for him to run for governor of Texas. Both him and Karl Rove spoke about in 2000 at great length how the fact that Bush finally had succeeded at something, even if it was just making money and being a smiling public face of the Rangers.
Not clear how much he succeeded other than getting the public money for the stadium. He traded away Sammy Sosa, and the team didn't do all that well. But.
Very true, very true. And it became basically the hothouse for steroids for all of Major League Baseball if you believe Jose Canseco, and frankly, there's no reason not to believe Jose Canseco at this point. So I would just throw that in as well. And I would also, since it's the end of the show, one of the callers did ask about this idea of activism in this, and that is why we started the Sports Fan Coalition, so we could do more than just be upset about how this situation works, but to actually try to fight to get that seat at the table so fans aren't forgotten when these negotiations take place.
And Dave, who are you targeting here? Because my dad's not very political, but he's such a big sports fan. How do you grab someone like him and get him involved in this?
I think it's you go after the issues that really affect sports fans, things like blackouts when NFL games aren't played because they haven't sold out the stadium, or when you have issues of public funding, or even issues like the BCS and whether or not there's going to be a playoff in college football. I mean, there are all kinds of issues which Capitol Hill is trying to sort of get its nose in, because the sports is always a winner in terms of getting cheap publicity. But I think as fans, if we can say we're tired of you using these things for cheap publicity, because we want to actually politically mobilize ourselves to make sure it's at the end of the day, it's not just players get this, owners get this, and fans get the shaft.
And 20 seconds, Dave, what would be at the top of your list? What would you like to see change?
Oh, I would love to see owners buy their own playpens, frankly. I mean, I would love to see owners have to actually, if they want a new stadium, they can pick up the tab themselves, Peter McGowan style.
And Andrew, 30 seconds, what would you like to see change realistically?
I'm not sure I have any simple solutions. I probably at this point in time would want to concentrate on things that are going on in college sports, like coaches getting $5 million eight-year contracts when the players in college sports aren't paid anything.
There
are a host of other things in college sports that I think are rather egregious. So I think that's where I'd start.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us. That's Andrew Zimbalist, a prominent sports economist at Smith College. His latest book is Baseball and Billions. His newest is Circling the Bases. And Dave Zirin, sports correspondent with The Nation magazine. The new organization is called the Sports Fan Coalition. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Dave's latest book is A People's History of Sports in the U.S. Thank you both for joining us, and we'll have both of you back to talk about your new books in a couple of months.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Thanks for your calls and emails. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. Is the U.S. government now accepting the return of the Taliban? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about plans to open negotiations with the Taliban. Afghan President Hamid Karzai wants to talk, and his backers are all for it. So how did this major shift happen so quickly? Join us live at 11 a.m. or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Are you in favor of pulling U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, regardless of what it means for the future of the Afghan people? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find links there to the Your Call blog and podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Pete Misick is our web editor. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.